This is Shavuot Unbound, mini episode 4, The Book of Ruth. Well, Lex, here we are for our fourth episode about Shavuot, and we're covering the Book of Ruth. So the Book of Ruth is one of the books in the writings, part of the Jewish canon. There's the Torah, the prophets, and the, quote, writings. These are all sort of hodgepodge of books that were, you know, sort of, how do we define the writings?
I think the only honest way to put it, and I actually love this, and we'll talk about it later, is that there were these really great stories that people loved and that didn't really logically fit in an order elsewhere in the text, but we didn't want to lose them. So we have this third section of some of the best literature in the Jewish tradition that's tacked on at the end, and Ruth is in that section with things like Esther and Lamentations and Ecclesiastes and all those goodies, Job.
Yeah, because what we call the prophets is really two genres of books. One are actual books of prophecy and prophets, and the other is sort of books of history, but that tell a particular linear history of the post-biblical, pre-exilic time in Jewish history. So, so the writings are just these kind of other books that are either stories or histories that don't really sort of exactly fit into that timeline. So the Book of Ruth is one of those. And why is it that we read the Book of Ruth on Shavuot traditionally?
Yeah, well, the first reason has to be that my mom's name is Ruth and Shavuot's my favorite holiday. So that's actually, I think, enshrined in Jewish tradition hi, Mom. But the actual sets of reasons, once again, we talked about this last episode with Derry. There's no one official reason, but we can guess at a few. And one of them is that in the text of the story of Ruth, it mentions that there had recently been the barley harvest. And for those who don't remember, Shavuot comes, so Passover marks the beginning of the barley harvest, and then you've got a long period of time happening, and Shavuot sort of marks the turn from the end of the barley harvest into the wheat harvest. So the fact that the barley harvest was recent, according to the text in Ruth, means that you're loosely in that period that would follow it, and that could coincide with Shavuot. Once again, it's not exactly that we know that there's this precise date where that happens, but it's just a loose association of the seasons. And then the other piece relates to the actual story, which is, you know, in the Book of Ruth, in the first chapter, actually, the big ticket moment that people love to reference is when Ruth either converts or at least expresses some sort of affinity for the God of the Israelites. She says, you know, your people will be my people, your God will be my God, where you dwell, I will dwell, etc. She's talking to her mother-in-law, Naomi. And what people say is that her acceptance of, they would say her acceptance of Judaism. She wasn't really accepting Judaism because Judaism wasn't quite the word for it yet, but her acceptance of this group of people, it can be analogized to our collective Jewish acceptance of the Torah that's associated with the day of Shavuot. So that's another way that people connect the two. The third, just really quickly, is that the story ends by mentioning that Ruth has a child, and eventually that child's grandchild is King David. So one of the main messages of the story is that, you know, this Moabite woman is eventually able to marry somebody of the Israelites and become an ancestor of King David, the most well-known king of the Israelites. And King David apparently is rumored to have died on Shavuot. So the fact that this story culminates with David makes Shavuot an appropriate moment to sort of look at it.
And you mentioned that Ruth was a Moabite woman, and I think it's really important to point out for our listeners that the Moabites there were kind of like one of the main enemies of the people of Judah. They were basically neighbors, and they didn't get along very well. And when you look at it that way, right, there's a shock value to this story that King David was a descendant of our worst enemies.
And what's interesting about it is there's been stuff written in biblical scholarship about this, because what appears to have happened and what may have been behind the reason that Ruth is mentioned as a Moabite is, like, there's obviously ebbs and flows in terms of how the Israelites are relating to their neighbors. And it appears that at certain points, the Moabites were the key definitive enemy of the people. And so that's when you've got elements of the text talking about how if you marry a Moabite, like, that's prohibited and way worse than anything you could do to marry some other tribe in the area. Midianites and Moabites are the two that they mention there. But then they also think that there are periods of relative, you know, peace between those nations, and perhaps that's when texts like this come about. But what's interesting is, regardless, people would have been reading this at various different points in history, where sometimes Moabite has that shock value and other times maybe it doesn't, but certainly for some it would. And I think that there's a huge teaching moment there for thinking about how we relate to outsiders. And on that note, I actually think there's sort of a lesson in this text for how not to do that, which is that Ruth commits to this group of people, to the Israelites, very early in the text, in the first chapter. It's a four-chapter book in the first chapter. And for the entire rest of the book, it emphasizes Ruth the Moabite, Ruth the Moabite, Ruth the Moabite. Now, whether you think she actually converted or not, conversion is a much later construct. But even if she didn't, she has expressed a desire to be a part of this group of people, and yet over and over we highlight the fact that she's an outsider. One of my favorite traditional teachings is that if somebody converts, you're never supposed to remind them that they were born not a Jew. Like, they're in. They are equally Jewish to anybody else. This has come up recently because over and over again, people talk about how Ivanka Trump converted to Judaism. You know, I'm no fan of Ivanka Trump, but she and Jared Kushner are equally Jewish. It's silly to talk about how she married a Jew or how Donald Trump has a Jewish son-in-law. Like, he has a Jewish daughter. That's just a factual thing. But yeah, I think there's something to learn from that. Did you have any other thoughts on sort of the story of it?
Well, I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying about the sort of anti-lesson of if she converted, right, to keep referring to her as a Moabite is a very negative thing. What's interesting to me is that there hasn't been at least that I'm aware of, sort of a traditional counter story that says the reason why it keeps saying Ruth the Moabite is because she didn't actually convert, right? You know, that when she said, your people will be my people, your God will be my God, she was not converting. By the way, we know that at that time in Jewish history, there was no concept of conversion. The only way to convert was for a woman to marry a Jewish man, and then she didn't really convert, but she was sort of taken in as part of the people, and that had a lot to do with patriarchy and all kinds of things like this. There's a lot of things in there that we wouldn't really much care for today, but you know, it's pretty clear that for the traditional writer, you know, not only did she not convert, but it was pretty clear that she did not convert because they keep referring to her as a Moabite. So you know, I think what's interesting about that is that for the writer at that time, right, it's almost even a more radical statement that King David was the descendant of a person who did not convert to Judaism. And again, when a woman married into a family, she sort of took on the identity of that family. So, you know, it's not as controversial as all that, but it's still kind of a pretty radical thing, I think, that it to point out that at least for the writer of that story, part of the point that they're making is that King David was a descendant very much of a people that, you're right, at least had a very touchy history with the people of Judah, where King David is from, for a long period of time. So I think in terms of what that has to do with us, I mean, like, I am kind of interested in exploring the possibility that this story is telling a story of someone who did not convert, right? That this is telling the story of somebody who is not a Jew, and nevertheless plays a really important set of roles in a Jewish community, right? She takes care of a Jew, Naomi. You know, she provides, you know, incredible love and care to a level that others in that society are not really giving to Naomi, right? They're kind of seeing her as this old lady who probably came from a family that maybe was sort of sketchy, right? They went to live in Moab, so maybe they were some kind of problematic family, and she comes back when her husband and sons die, and the community doesn't seem to care for her too much. They just see her as another pauper who can come and glean in the field. Ruth is the one who promises to take care of her. Ultimately, Ruth is the one who, you know, kind of gets things set up so that everyone will be okay. And she ends up being the foremother of King David. So I feel like this is like, I'm not saying that this is what the writer of the story intended. We can't know that. But I think for a time like the time in which we live, where we may be looking for traditional texts and traditional ideas that actually do honor to the potential role that non-Jews may have, not only as spouses, but and not only as fellow travelers, but maybe also as co-creators of a future version of Judaism, this might be a text that plays a particularly powerful role.
The other piece I wanted to mention is that as much as, sure, we can talk about the book of Ruth happens, the story of Ruth happens after the barley harvest, and there's like reasonable ways that you can draw this to the same time of year as Shavuot. There's nothing that says anywhere, oh, dear the Jews, Shavuot and Ruth should go together. No, what we did is we realized, oh, we've got this great story, Ruth, but it's floating around in contemporary bound books. It's all the way in the back. But we realized, oh, we want this incredible story to have an anchor point in the Jewish calendar year, because if it doesn't, people might not read it. We've got our cycle of the five books of the Torah. That's already a lot. We've got the Haftorah that go with the cycle of the weeks. So we got to find a place for this. And we did it not just with Shavuot, but we also found ways for other holidays to house, quote unquote, you know, different books of the writings. So obviously we've got Esther on Purim. That's the easiest one. We've got Lamentations that's associated with the fast of the 9th of Av. And also a lot of people read the book of Job on the 9th of Av. We've got Ecclesiastes, which is associated with Sukkot. We've got Song of Songs, which is associated with Passover. And if you ask me, a lot of these books are some of the most gorgeous expressions of deep emotion and raw power, like raw emotional impact that there is in the Torah. And I say that not because I grew up with them and experienced them. I actually, for the most part, didn't hear any of these stories, with the exception of Esther, until I was in college, because the circles I was in were emphasizing other parts of those holidays. But I think that if we really elevate some of these stories, they're really wonderful. They just teach us something about human emotion and how we navigate the world, from like the depths of Lamentations, which is, for those who haven't read it, is just this awful depiction of the degradation of society. And it's a really, really tough but emotional read, to books like this in Ruth that just really show us the power of a relationship, of Ruth and Naomi's connection to one another. I think there's some special stuff in these books, and we could benefit from exploring them.
Yeah, and it raises for me the question of, are there other books that we ought to be reading in a way like this? You know, I get why, both because it sort of forms a corpus of mythology and sort of a key sort of set of building blocks of Judaism, to say, you know, hey, this set of books that was canonized a couple thousand years ago is really what we ought to be reading over and over, what we should make sure that we read at least once a year, etc. But there are so many books and so many writings and thoughts in Judaism that have taken place between that time and this time that I think would really be so stirring to people if they knew about them. And it raises the question in my mind, how could we get more people to be reading those books? And sure, read these books too, but are there parts of the Talmud, you know, the Ethics of the Fathers, let's say, just as one example, or are there books of more recent vintage like Heschel's The Sabbath or Mordecai Kaplan's Judaism as a Civilization or whatever, you know, that really would actually be very thought-provoking for people, but we never read them and they don't even know about them. So, you know, I would suggest that in some ways the writings were an ancient version of that. You know, there were these great books that were floating around that if we didn't find a way to get them read, they would never be read. So they were assigned to the holidays. And it just sort of makes me think about, what about the books in our day and when could we assign those?
We don't say this much on the show, but I think there's something we could learn from Chabad on this front, actually. Because Chabad, the Hasidic sect, they've done this with some of the texts that they've identified as most crucial to the evolution of Judaism. So there is a cycle of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, his Jewish legal text, where you read, you know, a little smidgen every day, and eventually, I forget if it's over the course of the year or a few years, you read the whole thing. And they also do that with Tanya, which is one of the founding, it is the founding text written by Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the guy who started Chabad, and they have a little reading that you do each day over the course of the year that Mark, and I think we could, there's no reason we couldn't do that same thing with the texts that we believe are important for the current world of Judaism in the future.
Yeah. And as we talked about a couple of mini episodes ago, I think that there's this real opportunity to see Shavuot in our time as this annual time of sort of rethinking. And this is one of the topics that we might rethink, not only these sort of like large reimaginings of what Judaism might be in the future, but also these, let's say, smaller reimaginings of how might we put some of the pieces in place that would, you know, get a little bit more creativity going. And I'm glad that we've surfaced some big ones and some smaller ones.
I am too. And just to close out this mini episode and actually our whole mini series of Shavuot episodes, we want to just say thank you for listening to these. And if you have thoughts or feedback, please be in touch with us. There's our email addresses at dan@nextjewishfuture.org and lex@nextjewishfuture.org. And if this was a springboard into some thought, some contemplation for you, we hope that you'll check out Shavuot Unbound, which is housed on our website. And during Shavuot, it's our homepage. But after Shavuot, if you're listening afterwards, it can be found in our resources section. And we just have on there a wide variety of Jewish resources, from short little mini videos about the Torah portions to audio and video that actually isn't directly about Jewish sources, but is just wisdom that we think is worth thinking about this time of year. So we hope that you'll check that out and be in touch with us with any thoughts you have about it. With that, this has been Shavuot Unbound.